speaks up for herself and for change. She uses her voice and owns her story to create culture and community, fearlessly and unapologetically. Hi, I'm Purva Miller. Join me as I talk to trailblazers and changemakers about questioning the status quo, building success, and creating a life that truly inspires. So grab a cozy beverage of your choice and get comfy. This is the Women in Our Town podcast. It's our last episode of the year, which is kind of funny because it's only our third episode. But this one is really special because it pretty much encapsulates everything this year has been about. My guest today is Lena Anderson, an award-winning writer, health and disability advocate, and photographer living in Toronto. Born and raised in Denmark, Lena has had juvenile arthritis since she was 4 years old and has used a power wheelchair since her teens. She has a master's degree in social work and is a community leader of the Health Central Rheumatoid Arthritis website. Lena has written books on living with rheumatoid arthritis and chronic illness, and you can read her hilarious takes on her blog, The Seated View. She shares her perspective today on what life has meant for someone who is in one of the highest risk categories of contracting the coronavirus and succumbing to the ravages of this disease. 2020 has been an incredibly stressful year for all of us, and many of us have been afraid to live our lives in the ways we were used to. Going to the grocery store has become stressful. Going to the doctor has become stressful. Giving your parents a hug has become stressful. But we've also been forced to stop our navel gazing and start to think about the world and the people around us more than we ever have before. My chat with Lena is a reminder of how this disease can impact everyone differently, and how so much of someone else's mental and physical well-being is affected by our collective actions and our willingness to make sacrifices. But it's not all doom and gloom. Lena is also someone who is very hopeful and joyful, and so we can take a page out of her book about finding joy and love and togetherness without the traditional trappings of a very Merry Christmas. Let's talk to Lena. Welcome, Lena. Thank you for joining me this morning on the Women in Our Town podcast. I'm so thrilled to have you back and to be getting to talk to you about, you know, this has been such a crazy year. I can't believe we're in December already. And I know it is historically, from reading your book, your favorite time of year. Welcome.
Thank you. And thank you so much for having me. I can't believe that it's December already. It turns out that so much about being in the December holiday mood is about being out and about and having the cues and the music and all of that.
Yeah. But,
so I'm just very disconnected right now.
Oh my goodness. And it's just, I mean, I am still reeling from the year we've had. I cannot believe it. If someone had said this to me last year that, you know, next year the entire world's going to shut down and life as you know it is going to change, I would have said, you know, I don't know. I think you put too much, you know, rum in your eggnog.
Yeah, it's like, I know I've been reading articles for several years about epidemiologists saying it's coming, it's just a matter of time. Yeah. And yet we were all surprised.
Yeah, absolutely. And so what's this year been like for you? What's it been like kind of living and managing? Managing a chronic illness is a challenge in the best of times. What's it been like? And, you know, when there's so many restrictions on everybody?
Well, there's kind of two sides to this. And one is that all of a sudden, most of the world, or at least those who are following advice for restrictions, are experiencing what life is like with a chronic illness. Right. Because most of us who have a chronic illness that affects your life either permanently or temporarily, we're very familiar with the staying at home, not going out, having to cancel social events, fatigue, stress, etc., and being isolated from the people you love. So that's kind of, not much has changed. I'm also lucky that I can work, but I did at least a little bit. And I've been doing that from home. So really, in many ways, my daily life hasn't changed a whole amount. Yeah. I think the difference is the social isolation of not seeing right. my friends, not going to museums, not hopping on the streetcar and exploring the city.
Yeah.
Not having the option for that. And also, like, speaking of options, I think it's especially that you have to think about, is it really necessary to go outside?
Yeah.
And sometimes it is just for fresh air and mental health. But at the same time, you always have to do that assessment of, especially when you're high risk like I am. And I think, like, many more people than we think are actually high risk. It's not just people who are very elderly and frail or people who are obviously disabled. It's many more people than that. But that whole, so I'm going out, that means going into an elevator. Elevators are scary places.
Yeah.
Because it's an enclosed environment where a lot of virus can be hanging around. Yeah. And then you go outside, and it was a lot easier in the summer when the cases were low and you felt a lot safer. But now we're back inside where every day is a negotiation of the risk. I also think, for me, because I have attendant care, which is essentially PSWs coming in to help me with what's called tasks of daily living, that is my biggest risk vector.
Yeah.
Because although the provincial government restricted PSWs working in nursing homes to only one nursing home very early on, I think April, May, something like that, PSWs working in community care are not restricted. So most of the people who provide assistance to me are working in two or three different places.
Right.
And everybody in the sector knows that the next big sector to be hit is community care.
Yeah.
And I got a really interesting reminder of this yesterday. Yeah, yesterday I was notified that I was exposed over the weekend to someone who is positive.
Oh, wow. Oh my
and,
God.
And that was one of the PSWs. So yes,
right.
So now I'm trying to arrange for testing and finding the best time, et cetera.
It's, you know, it's such, I sometimes sit and think about this, and I think that, you know, if somebody wanted to design a disease that could really just get us, this would be the perfect one, because it's so undetectable. It's so contagious. You can have it and not have symptoms. And so unless you were, you know, the tests are only valid for a couple of days, and then it's out the window. So what, do you just keep getting tested every time you're afraid? And it's just, I can't even imagine. So, you know, you posted a picture on your Instagram a few weeks ago, and that, I mean, it was, and I know you posted a trigger warning, and I think it is a triggering photo, because I was, you know, it definitely created a reaction and a feeling in me when I saw it. And you spoke openly about being hospitalized and being in the ICU from influenza and being terrified about, you know, of course, as anyone would be. And ICUs are scary places. I've spent time in the ICU as a heart patient, and I remember never in my life, even though I was in good care, never in my life have I felt more afraid and felt like I was the closest to perhaps not making it than when I was in the ICU. Can you talk to me a little bit about the fear that you've had over, if you know, the fear of the last 9 months of being sort of in a more vulnerable position with this pandemic raging around us?
Well, I think to that point, because it was only 4 years ago that I was in the ICU, I have a very vivid memory of what the potential consequences are, as does my family. And it makes it a whole lot more real for me than I think for a lot of people, because I think a lot of the mass compliance issues, et cetera, comes from people just they can't imagine. It's just, well, it's like a slightly worst case of the flu, but I'll be fine, right?
Yeah.
And there is that, there isn't quite that sense of personal risk until you really experience someone close to you, or you've experienced it yourself, that increased risk or just the consequences of the risk. And for me, I found myself leaving a comment on an Instagram post a little couple of weeks ago that led to that post on my Instagram, which is at the Seat of View, by the way, about being terrified every day since this started in March.
Yeah.
And I hadn't realized just how scared I was all the time mm-hmm. until that sort of like, oh, yes, there it is. Because I got really good repression talents. It's my favorite defense mechanism is just repress the crap out of everything. But it is really every day you get up. And first, there's the exhaustion of the latest news and reassessing every part of you in terms of what does this mean for my risk? What does this mean for what I do? What does this mean? Can I go shopping for my mother? Can I go shopping for myself? You know, all of that. Mm-hmm. But because that ICU stay and what happens is so fresh in my mind, and I also ended up with medical PTSD as a result. So there's obviously the pandemic is a huge trigger for my PTSD, but even without that anxiety disorder, there is that whole, I remember what it was like to wake up. Thankfully, by the time I woke up fully, they were giving me anti-anxiety medication and, you know, the repression technique kicked in. So I wasn't really scared until after I left.
Yeah, when you kind of think back on it.
Yeah, and I remember like waking up and then the next thing I remember when they tried to take out the tubes from the ventilator, I crashed and flatlined. So I woke, and then by the time I next woke up, I had a tracheostomy.
My goodness.
And couldn't speak for 10 days because once you have a trach, you can't really speak.
Yeah.
So that for me was the scariest thing. I know for my my family, by the time I actually woke up, they had already spent 2 weeks trying to persuade me to not die because I was on a ventilator for 2 weeks and came very, very close to not making it. So it was an adventure of sorts that I wouldn't wish on anyone. And at least I could have my family there and they could be there. They could, like, even when I was in isolation initially, they could, you know, gown up, put on the gloves and come sit with me.
Yeah.
But these days you don't get that. So if it's someone you love who's in there in the ICU, or even in a regular hospital bed, you don't get to visit.
Yeah.
And they don't get to have the comfort of having you there.
Yeah.
Which is huge because, as you said, ICUs are scary places. And at least your family gives you a sense of normalcy and something to hold on to.
Yeah.
So I definitely think that's a big part of the fear is that whole knowing what it's like.
Yeah.
And just having a really, really recent reminder of how quickly you can get very, very sick. I had the flu.
Yeah.
And then I got pneumonia. And the thing about pneumonia, people also sort of go, oh, no, that's, you know, you get antibiotics, you're fine. Mm-hmm. People still die of pneumonia.
Yeah.
Which is my time to plug, get the pneumonia vaccine. It protects you.
Yeah.
At least for some. I think I probably got sidetracked here. But it's just that whole constant awareness of it can go very, very badly.
Yep.
And I think also for younger people, though people under 40 are much less likely to die from COVID.
Yeah.
Yeah, quite likely, like really high percentage likely to get continuing symptoms.
Yes.
That may or may not be chronic as the rest of your life.
Yeah. It's, you know, you're so right about that, because just to kind of come back to what you said about comfort of having your family in the ICU, I, you know, as someone who has spent a considerable amount of time in the ICU, I can attest to that it's, I remember waking up from a surgery and my husband was standing beside me and I could hear his voice. My mom was talking to me and I just, even though I could not understand anything else, I couldn't remember why I was where I was and what had just happened. It was just so familiar to have them there. And that just calmed me and made me feel so much better. And they were with me the entire time. But it's scary and it can go wrong so quickly. I was talking to a friend of mine last night and she was telling me of someone she knows that's a young woman in her early 30s. Recently, when it was hospitalized, they, you know, didn't understand what was wrong with her. They're not even sure yet if it was COVID or not. They think it was, and went into cardiac arrest and died. It was, and it's just, I think, and she wasn't even presenting severe symptoms. She was not on a ventilator. She was not, you know, hooked up to things. They were just kind of monitoring her. And obviously, because it's such a scary time right now, any little bit of something being wrong with someone, the doctors kind of want to keep you and they want to keep you quarantined. They want to make sure that you're not a danger to the rest of the population. And it's crazy. I heard another story of someone who lost someone in their family who was 26 years old in the early days of COVID, healthy, young, you know, nothing to be terribly concerned about. So it's so much about the strain that you get, the level of exposure that you get, and you don't know how what that's going to be like. You don't know what you're going to end up with. It's how much of it you get, the volume of exposure. There's just so many things. And I think I can't imagine, and I'd love to get your thoughts on it, what it's been like this year watching the anti-mask movement and all these people, you know, going out there and saying that, you know, the masks don't protect people and not socially distancing, not following regulations, everything becoming so political and becoming this like giant political debate when it's very simple. It's that we have to start thinking about other people. We have to start thinking beyond ourselves. If anything this year, if you take anything away, it's that we don't live in isolation. We have such a direct impact on the people around us. And so, you know, I'd love to get your thoughts on kind of what it's been like kind of watching the way the world has kind of gone a little bit ballistic about this.
Well, part of me sometimes am glad that having RA or rheumatoid arthritis since I was a child means I can't reach the top of my head because I would have been pulling out my hair. So at least the reason I still have hair is because of that. But I think it depends on the day. Some days I'm very aware that people are not getting the same information I might be getting.
Yeah.
Which can lead us down a rabbit hole of talking about paywalls to media, which I understand you have to pay for good journalism. But at the same time, if people then can't access the journalism, then that's my soapbox this week. But I also think, I think a couple of things. I think people don't understand the process of science.
Right.
Because I think a lot of people keep talking about, but first you said it didn't help and now it does. And it's like, yes, it's called novel coronavirus. Yeah. We'd never seen it before.
Yeah.
And it takes a while to science to figure out what it is and what can prevent it and all of this, right?
We're learning as we go.
We absolutely are. And as a science nerd, it's kind of thrilling on one level. On the other hand, right, it contributes to that whole, so what do I need to learn today kind of thing, right?
Right.
I think at the core, it might be about denial.
Yeah.
I'm not going to talk about the politicization of it quite yet, but I think at its core, it comes down to, is it going to hurt you to wear a mask?
Yeah.
And let's say we all wear a mask for 6 months. And then at the end of it, we go, oh, well, it didn't help after all. Is it going to have hurt you? Right?
Right.
And it isn't. It's a piece of cloth in front of your face.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's one way to say that, you know, you have people, at least initially, the 7:30 p.m. clapping for healthcare workers. Mm-hmm. As I saw one healthcare worker say on Twitter, I think it says, I really appreciate it, but please also wear a mask.
Yeah.
So I don't get overwhelmed. And so right, I don't have to take care of you because right, the less people we end up with in hospital, the better.
Right.
Like that's, and I think people don't quite, it's like, oh, it's the heroes. We'll let them go in first in line and we'll clap for them. But what you don't realize that what actually helps is not getting it.
Yes, exactly.
And so I think understanding science, having patience with finding the right sources. How do you know what's the right sources? What's a legit fact and what's a in the words of a certain political figure, an alternate fact. It's just, and like, incredible. Anyway, and I think there is the asking yourself, I really hope all these dire things that people are saying is not correct, right? Like if you're in that boat, but what if they are?
Right.
And then is a mask going to hurt me?
Yeah.
Is not having Christmas, and we'll get back to that, I know, going to hurt me? Yes, it's going to be really difficult. But what if you're the one, I read an article in the paper today about a small family gathering mm-hmm. in Niagara where people came from another jurisdiction. And it was really small. And one person turned out to have COVID, and now two members of that family are on ventilators. And yeah. It's and another recent stats I read that 70% of the cases, I think it was 70%, it was really high percent of the cases are driven by these small family gatherings because people stay and they take off their mask and they eat and they talk and they laugh.
Yeah.
Which, you know, so much for bubbling, right? But
yeah,
you can bubble when the risk is lower. Right. Now you can't bubble, right? So
right.
So I think it's that whole, well, yes, it hurts and yes, it's awful. Mm-hmm. But being careful means that I am leading with kindness. And I do think that most people lead with kindness.
I agree.
Like it's one of the things that impresses me. As an immigrant to North America, it's one of the things that really impresses me about Canada and the U.S. is how willing people are to donate their time and their yes. money often
yes.
to help other people and to volunteer. Like, I come from Europe. The idea of volunteering just like, yeah. What do you mean you're working and without getting paid, right? Like, people help each other, but it's yes. not that volunteer thing. So
yeah.
everybody I know, whether virtually or in person, find some way to give back. And one of the easiest way you can give back right now is to wear a mask and not get close.
Yep. I agree with you so much on this point. I've noticed this and I've seen the sort of, you know, coming back to what you said about fear, which was, we talked about earlier, if me wearing a mask means that when I'm in the grocery store, somebody that is at a higher risk for getting it, even if I don't fear getting COVID, I'm not saying I don't because I do, but if somebody that is at a higher risk for getting COVID feels less afraid because we are all living with so much fear, that in of itself is a gesture of kindness towards people around you. And so, it's interesting because I grew up in Europe as well, and you're totally right on the volunteering point, but I do think people are willing to give their time, give their money, give their attention as long as they feel that they're the one making the choice. And I think so much of it is because we're quote unquote being told to do something that everybody just kind of feels that they need to rebel against it. But we're told to do things all the time. We live in a society and we abide by a social contract and that's how society functions. And so this is just, you know, maybe it's just this period of change because it's such a drastic change. And I really, really hope that if this disease is around for a while longer, while they figure out the vaccines, people start to adapt and understand that, you know, yes, it's really not going to hurt you to what you're going to go out for like 10 minutes, an hour at most. It's a piece of cloth on your face.
You know what? Every day, like, okay, so every day I'm terrified. Every day I'm pissy. Because I don't want to do this anymore. I miss my friends. I haven't seen any of my friends, except one person who's bubbled with me during the summer. But other than that, I haven't seen my friends since February. I have seen my sister and my nephews once mm-hmm. since February. And won't be seeing them for Christmas, you know, except for a 5-minute outdoor visit while we all shiver on the sidewalk, right? Mm-hmm. But it's like, maybe it's because it's invisible.
Right.
Because if you're at war, everybody understands you got to do your bid. Nobody yeah. likes it, but you still do it. And I saw somebody comparing it to a war the other day.
Right.
And it's yeah. like, And a bomb is a real threat. Like if you're looking at World War II, for instance, like, you know, you have declared a war and it's very obvious and there's an enemy and there are soldiers and there's people dying. And so you do your bit. But and this is a war as well. Like it's a war on with an invisible enemy who some people in some corners of the internet and the real world are very determined to not take seriously.
Yeah.
And to ignore or out of a political motivation minimize so that the economy can going can keep going. And it's like, I know as a small business owner, I took a major hit from the pandemic as well. And I understand, like I really understand when you go down a street in Toronto and you see store after store after store being closed.
Right.
Like, I understand the impact, but here's the thing. I think you can balance both. I think you can keep people healthy while finding other ways to support the economy. I think you can. Yeah, I definitely think there's a balance to it and you don't have to choose one or the other. But I also think part of the problem is just the nature of the communication. It's back to our thing about science. It is, it has been variable because the science has been evolving. But I also think like once you have politicians being the main driver of the information, then it by definition has a bias. Like I think it needs to be people like Dr. Bonnie Henry from BC, who I don't always agree with, but that whole get the politicians out of the frame and focus on the experts.
Right.
And I think the despite everything we learned from SARS, where we had a pandemic playbook, and we knew what to do, and then we haven't done it. Why are we not doing that, right? Like, and why is it being like, and thankfully we live in Canada where there is some politicization, hello Alberta, but and Ontario, I think. But you look at the U.S. And I have so many people I consider friends in the U.S. that I've met in person or I met over the, in the chronic illness community. And I just despair of what's going on there where it's just become this choice.
Yeah.
Well, what do you believe? And we're back to facts and alternate facts, right?
Yeah. When something's important, it will get attention. And up until now, like you said, the SARS playbook and all the things that we learned, but I guess it was just not considered important. Maybe it was not as, you know, it didn't spread in the same way, at the same rate, at the same, you know, there were so many, there's so many considerations, but this has not spared anyone, right? This is, everyone's affected. Anyone is vulnerable to getting this disease. And well, so it's... And
when Rachel Maddow came back to her show after being away for a few weeks, she did this heartbreaking and inspiring a few minutes talking about how her partner had been positive. She was negative herself, but her partner had almost died from it. And she said that it is not about the risk you're willing to assume for yourself. But you have to think about it in the context of what am I willing to risk for the person I love most in the world?
Yeah.
And that really puts a different spin on it because it's like, yeah, people might be thinking, oh yeah, I'm fine, whatever. But when you think about the fact that it could be your spouse, your child, your mother, your grandparent, whatever, and remember that when you go around without a mask or you get together with friends, people are very impressionable. We are, peer pressure is a real thing. And if when we see people act as if it's not anything to worry about, then they go, well, that person who I trust and whose opinion I value, they're acting as if this is not risky. So then you instinctively do the same, or you minimize, like it starts eroding you the ways you are careful,
right?
And that means that even though you may not be seeing your grandma or your mother and you go out, that means the people you go out with, their partner, their parents, their grandmother, their children are at most at increased risk. So I think once you start seeing it as this is about who I love the most and the risk they're exposed to, not just from me, but from other people who are also doing the same thing that I am. It really is, because it's not just about what I'm doing. It's about what other people are doing. And if I see somebody in my circle not taking it seriously, that indirectly puts the person I love the most at risk.
Yes.
Right?
You're right.
Because they could meet them in a grocery store. Like, they may not, they don't need to come to their door.
Yeah.
Like, you could cough on a carton of milk in the grocery store and there goes the person I love most in the world.
It's so grim.
It's grim.
It's actually, you're right. When you start diving into it, I mean, I think part of the coping mechanism is that you don't think about it every day and you try to kind of live your life to the best of that you can within the constraints of this pandemic. But when you actually start getting into it and drilling down into it, you're absolutely right. And, you know, I don't think this might be sort of my, you know, I would call it out in many ways, privilege of being younger or able-bodied or maybe not as high a risk as somebody else. But I don't think twice about it when my husband goes out to get groceries. I think he's going to be careful and he'll be okay. But he mostly goes out and does the grocery shopping because we just think, you know, maybe it's better for one person to be exposing themselves. But you're right. He could get it. He's young. He's able-bodied. He could get it from a carton of milk. And like, you know, like I said earlier, he gets a bad strain of it, when you start thinking about this could be the person I love most in the world, that's when it really hits home. And so I think so.
And I really like when Rachel Maddow said that, because it's like, although I'm very connected to the risk, this is, I think, one of the key ways of helping people understand.
Yeah.
That, and we're back to that, like, you know, until now, you have a pretty low chance of getting it. Like, the winter's going to be bad. We all know that.
Yeah.
But you know what? Like, it's what a lot of people in the US said around Thanksgiving is, we stay apart now so that we get together again. All of us are there. And that's as simple as that. But I also think, like, to a point now that we've gotten really grim and hopefully people are still listening, is like, you have to find ways to connect to hope and optimism.
Yes.
Because otherwise, like, surviving is really difficult.
Yeah.
And I think ideally without involving alcohol or other intoxicants as coping tools. And I think that's where, even though seeing someone on the screen is not the same as being with them in person, having those face-to-face Zoom calls or Skype calls or whatever has been a godsend, because it's like, oh, a person, a real person, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And getting out for walks when you can, and controlling your media input. Like, at a certain point, I took Twitter off my phone because I was just doom scrolling constantly and couldn't handle, and it just made me more anxious. So it was that whole big moment saying, okay, what contributes to my anxiety? What contributes to this feeling that I must consume all the news in order to be aware of everything at all times?
Yes.
And like, right, Twitter is a big part.
Yes. Yes.
So I'm treating my social media now as if I were on an intermittent fasting diet. And I allow myself social media only at certain times and for so long. And it's been tremendously helpful.
Yeah. It's, you know, in some ways I was thinking about this, and actually I was thinking about this last night. Has social media gotten more authentic or less authentic this year? And I think a lot of people feel like in many ways it's gotten more authentic, but you're right. The breaks from social media, I have a better day when I'm not on my phone all the time, constantly looking at you know, people's posts and Twitter. And I always have a better day. I have a better mental health day when I'm not on my phone. And I think, you know, to sort of cap off this point, what you said earlier about when you, I think as human beings, it's human nature to always think about the world in context of yourself. It's just how we are as people. And so, yes, I can feel that, yes, my consequences will have action. My actions will have consequences. I'm sorry, for somebody that I've never met. And I can understand that logically, but because I don't have a personal connection to that person, it's hard for me to then apply it to myself and take all the necessary steps that I need to. But when you put it in the context of this could be your husband, your wife, your brother, your sister, your child, it hits home. And it's grim, but I think to segue into something a little bit more hopeful, it's Christmas. It's in many ways a magical time if you're a special time, if you're even this year, which I know it's going to look completely different for all of us. And I know from reading your book, Chronic Christmas, it's your favorite time of year. What's Christmas going to look like this year for you?
My Christmas is probably going to be, it is going to be completely different from what we normally do. Normally, myself, my partner, my sister, her partner and her kids, and a couple of friends get together at my mother's. We have the best meal of the year and sing carols very badly. And we had originally, obviously that many people in a 2-bedroom apartment is not good. So we had originally rented my mother at the party room in my mother's condo, thinking that it's a really big room.
Right.
We could still be together. We could each bring our own food, but we would at least be able to be together. But that obviously isn't happening. Mm-hmm. So the actual family part of it is my sister and her family are driving in from Brantford for a 5-minute, driving an hour and a half in and then an hour and a half back. So we can spend 5 minutes together on a freezing sidewalk to say Merry Christmas, which because she's saying, I'm seeing you on Christmas, damn it. That's what's important. And bringing cookies as is always her gift, which is also important, I think. But I think that speaks to finding the essential about Christmas. And for me, the essential is being together with the people I love. So that I'm going to be missing that. But I think what I want to do very much is still focus on the hygge aspect, which is something I talk about in the book. It's a Danish concept. I know it was big a couple of years ago where everybody knew about it, but it sort of translates to cozy, but togetherness and very much without pressure to be perfect and just about focusing on what makes you have that feeling of contentment and coziness and just feeling safe and loved and all of that. So I have a number of candles, both live and battery operated. What I'm hoping for is that by Christmas Eve, the numbers are going to be low enough that we can actually go spend some time with my mother, who lives, we live close to each other. And so we can at least have just the three of us for Christmas and spend some time together. That's the ideal. And if not, I guess we have to rely on Zoom and whether we do Zoom dinner together or do a Zoom call and sing carols very badly and probably will be even more painful for on actual in your ear when you're wearing earphones. But I think it's about finding what makes you feel the holidays the most and finding a way to incorporate it into what you're doing this year.
Right. And I would agree with that. You know, my tree went up a couple of weeks ago and I was seeing all over Instagram people right after Halloween. It was like October 31st has passed. It's November 1st. This is my holiday tree and it's up. Yeah. And so it was, I think a lot of people are leaning into the holidays by decorating early, staying, keeping things small from what I've heard and from talking to my friends, keeping things small and with, just with maybe a couple of core people and having, things with the rest of the family over Zoom. I think gift giving has become a lot more digital this year, which is great. So, you know, sending gift cards from your favorite stores or subscriptions or, you know, things that will make life at home easier. So I think that it is looking like a different Christmas, but I think one of the great things is that we adapt, right? And we find ways to still celebrate and find togetherness and find hygge, yeah, coziness. I hope I said it right. I was like, almost close enough.
And I think that's one of the best things about being a person is that humanity, one of our genetic hardwired abilities is the ability to adapt to something new. And I think it's important to remember that coming into Christmas, because it's so easy to focus on all the things you don't get to do.
Yeah.
And instead shifting that focus to, well, what can I do to make it special? What can I do to still have that connection to others? What can I do to feel better, especially if I'm feeling really depressed? Mm-hmm. Suicide hotlines are out there for a reason, especially on holidays.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of those key things is let's just, and it works really well for people with chronic illness. Getting back to the book, one of the things I recommend is in a season that is normally so exuberant and so packed with everything, that when you have a chronic illness, like doing that is a surefire recipe to be crashed out by Christmas and not enjoying it.
Yeah.
So it's about really focusing in on what means the most to you, what gives you the greatest joy, and then forgetting about all the non-essentials.
Yeah.
And I think that can stand us in really good stead this year, especially because it's something we all have to do. And it's going to be hard, but one of the ways that I cope is by shifting, just cope with having a chronic illness and disability in the first place, is by making that shift from instead of looking at what I can't do and don't have, I try to look at what I can do and what I do have. And it's work. It's not easy, but it's the only way for me to build a sense of joy.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we've talked about this, choosing joy and how joy is work. And you have to make a conscious effort to choose to be happy, to find happiness in little things, because it's, I think, in many ways, we are hardwired to complain and to find problems, right? Yeah. And everybody has reasons to complain. Everybody has challenges. And so I think that this year, maybe one of the greatest gifts we can give ourselves and the people around us is to find those moments, find those, you know, simple things and accept that it's not going to be a perfect Christmas. It's actually really interesting. So I found your book, Chronic Christmas, hilarious, but I also found it's great, but it was also really eye-opening for me because for example, the part where you talk about going shopping at a mall and how the malls are filled with all the Christmas smells and they spray all these perfumes in stores and to get people to buy things. I mean, there's a lot of research around the psychology behind why stores do these kinds of things and why retail does it. But I never knew that was something that would actually be, I mean, I've been in stores where I'm like, oh, this is smelling too much like gingerbread and I'm going to start to get a headache. And I'll say that colloquially and walk out, but I didn't actually ever think about how it can really have an impact on people. And
yeah, there's a lot of people triggered by scents, like people with asthma.
Yeah.
I have to hold my breath every time I go by a Lush store. Yeah. But then I think everybody does. That's really intense.
That's actually how I find a Lush store, to be honest. When I don't know where it is in the mall, I'm like my nose is, I'm like a bloodhound.
My sister-in-law has really severe migraines. She can't even, like, never mind Lush. Like, if you just have, she can't go down the aisle in the supermarket where the laundry detergent is, because it'll trigger her to be basically lose the next 2-3 days. So there's a lot of people who are very triggered by scent. And one of the things I do in chronic Christmas is give people who love someone with chronic illness and who want to help but don't know what to do some very specific tip. Yeah. And one of them is do the mall shopping. Yeah. Go to where all the people and the intensity and the lineups and the bad smells are. And do the shopping for someone, like if they have last minute things to pick up, right?
Yeah.
So it's like little practical tips on how you can make this whole season much easier.
And I think that, you know, it's actually in a year like this one, there's a lot of stress around the holidays, but there are a lot of things that we can completely skip this year. We don't need the pressure of the perfect Christmas dinner to host for 25 people because the whole family is coming over and the host is driving themselves crazy, decorating the house, cleaning the house, buying all the gifts, getting everything organized, making all the recipes. You know, I think that there is something to be said for it's going to be a much more, hopefully, relaxed Christmas in terms of the pressures of what it means. And for some reason, we've decided to make the holidays this really pressure-filled time with lots of social engagements and lots of, you know, living up to a lot of expectations. But maybe that's one of the if there's a silver lining, that's something that we could
well,
potentially
yeah, because especially when I wrote that book, but also in general, I'm also, why does it always fall to one person to make this perfect thing for the whole family and wreck themselves in the process? It's like, why isn't it that everybody brings a dish?
Yeah.
That you know, like many hands make light work, right?
Yeah.
One of my favorite sayings is like, why is it always one person's responsibility to make it perfect, right?
Yeah.
But I also think that one lesson from my own life is I'm from Denmark. Christmas is the 24th of December in the evening, and then you do specific things, right? It's sacred, and it always has been. It's everything else can be moved except Christmas. And then at one point, my sister got divorced and her ex has the kids every other year for Christmas, which is when we discovered it doesn't actually matter if you move it. So for me, I'm seeing this as a delayed Christmas, and it may be possible that we have it in June next year.
Right.
We'll have it.
Yeah.
So what we have now is a smaller version, a cozier version, something that's a lot more about focusing in and finding other ways to celebrate it.
Yeah.
But the big meal and everything, you can do that in 6 months.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. And when you do, make sure you're not the only one responsible for it, because that's just unfair.
Yeah. Christmas is about family. It's about being together, but it's also about the moments. And so any day can essentially be Christmas, right?
Absolutely.
Any day can be, it doesn't. So like you said, if Christmas is in June, Christmas is the traditions. It's going to be togetherness. It's going to be the love. And
yeah. So maybe we're wearing t-shirts and shorts, but they do that in Australia anyway for Christmas.
Yeah,
so,
yeah,
you know, maybe you have Australian Christmas. I don't know, but it's like one of those things, because I think we take holidays so seriously and they have to be the exact same way every year. And it's like, no, it doesn't. And this is actually a really good opportunity to kind of take a look at what isn't working.
Yes.
Is there something about it that always makes one person exhausted?
Yeah.
Is there something about it that always creates a fight?
Yeah.
Is there something about it that means that you come into January with no money? Like, you can look at it and start parsing it out and saying, maybe there are things we can do differently.
Yeah.
And I also think just delaying it is good, because when we think of December, like a normal December is so full, and then comes January 2nd.
Yep.
You've recovered from New Year's.
Yep.
And it is nothing but dark and cold, at least up in the Western area, right?
Yeah.
For the next 3 months. And it's like, January is terrible.
Yep.
So, several years ago, a friend of mine and I, we started doing this thing where we give each other the gift of time for Christmas, which means we're not getting together and we're not getting presents. Mm-hmm. Because then we don't have to worry about each other, but we're going to go out to dinner in January. Now, obviously this is more likely to be in the summer. Like, we'll get together or we'll do something. Maybe it'll be a special Zoom call with, you know, wine and snacks on each side or whatever, right? But let's move it to January, where it's going to be really depressing.
Something to look forward to. I completely agree with you. I have, you know, I definitely get hit with the blues. I try to leave my Christmas tree up for an extra week in January, just because I'm so down after all of the you know, the high of Christmas and all the social engagements and the gifts and the parties. And so, and then at least in Canada, we have a long winter, a long, cold, dark winter ahead of us. And it's hard. And so by the second week of January, people start saying, hey, do you want to go out for dinner? Do you want to have drinks? Do you want to, you know, maybe we should plan to go somewhere. And so it's funny because this year has really thrown everything off course. It's all like, I was thinking back to what a typical year is like, and it's kind of always the same beats. You have Christmas, then around Jan, Feb, people start to plan their winter break to go somewhere south, to go to the Caribbean or to Florida or wherever, because it's going to be a long, cold winter in Canada. Then everyone gets excited about the summer. And then we get into the fall and it's Halloween, and then we're back at Christmas. And those are sort of that's the cycle. That's the same cycle we repeat every single year. And this year has been so, so different. But I think that this has been a good year for that reckoning of looking at what isn't working on so many levels. And I think we've realized that there was a lot that hasn't been working for people.
Yeah. I think both systemically on the social level, but I also think, and it's really hard, it just makes the pandemic even harder. But what I try to remember is that there is no growth without pain.
Exactly.
And that opportunity to kind of sit with things and go, well, wait a minute. Why am I doing this one thing that I really don't enjoy? Yeah. And is there a different way of doing that? Why am I, what is my contribution to some sort of inequity? What pressure can I bear to bring to resolving that? And I think it's, if you can't afford it, a therapist is a really good idea right about now.
Yeah.
And it's certainly something I did a couple of months ago. I went, you know what? I don't have to do this alone.
Yeah.
So whether it's a therapist or simply just talking to your friends, because one of the lies of being isolated, and I think this is something that people with chronic illness know very intimately, and others are realizing now, that the less you talk about it, the more convinced you become that you're the only one experiencing this. And whether it's talking about finding a different way to do Christmas, we can share ideas what other people are doing, whether it's Christmas or any other December-ish holiday. There are... By talking about it, you get to let go of the feeling of the awful, which is part of what brings you to, okay, what can I do instead? But first you need to acknowledge and process the feelings in any situation before you can get to, okay, how can I pivot from this and do something different? And there's tons of things that you can do to still bring in joy to your life. Seasonally or in general, or in January and February when things are going to get worse. And practicing them and doing it every day is part of what gives you that sustained resilience.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think that this year more than any has shown us that we kind of, in so many respects, we have a collective responsibility. And I think talking about it, we also have a collective responsibility, and we have to incur that, you know, I don't want to say burden, but we have to be willing to share for the sake of sharing and for the sake of talking. I think it's, you know.
Well, and getting back to that good old adage of many hands make light work, and whether that's being an ally to people who are, who have less privilege, who are struggling is important, or whether it's picking up and talking to that strong friend who's always coping.
Yeah.
And who really isn't, and calling them up and say, hey, I'm here, you want to chat or watch a movie together on Netflix while you're on the phone or something, right? Like it's remember that the people who seem really strong probably aren't.
Yeah.
And that if you're feeling something, regardless of what it is, if you're having trouble, then so are other people. And it's not a misery loves company. It's more a, well, I'm not alone. And just that feeling of not being alone and feeling seen and knowing that other people feel the same, think the same, is the first step to getting out of it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. It's I can't believe I'm going to quote her, but I recently read this article written by the Duchess of Sussex, Meghan, where she, in the New York Times, where she said, sometimes the most important thing you can do, or the biggest thing you can do for someone, is to simply ask, are you okay? And I think this is the year of asking, the people around us if they're okay. Lena, thank you so much. Thank you for sharing. Thank you for, sharing your insights, your story. I'm such a big fan of your work and I love what you're doing. And I hope you have a warm and safe holiday and Merry Christmas. And I hope that you have Christmas in June and celebrate like Australians and get that time with your family.
Thank you so much for having me and happy holidays to everybody who's listening. I hope you made it to the end past the doom and gloom part.
Yeah, I hope so. Because that's got a lot more cheerful.
Well, and it's like, there's nothing wrong with, I think, in light of what we're talking about, like you got to talk about what's scaring you before you can get to the good stuff. So that's kind of, it was a very meta.
It was very meta, but that's our show. So thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. And thank you for listening.
Well, that's our show for this year, guys. I'm going to take a moment here and express my gratitude to all the women that have shared their stories on Women in Our Town, on the blog or the podcast, and to everyone that has listened and participated in the conversation. I wish you all a safe and joyful holiday season. And I think I'm not alone in saying that this New Year's, however you're celebrating, is going to be the biggest New Year's party the world has ever seen. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back with more phenomenal women to talk to in 2021. If you enjoy our content, you can find lots more of it on our website, womeninourtown.com, or join the conversation on Instagram at womeninourtown. See you next year, folks.